I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Yaman Chouinard, founder of the outdoor apparel company Patagonia. Yaman started Patagonia in 1973, and the company exemplifies social and environmental responsibility. Some of its efforts include donating 1% of sales to environmental efforts, making its cotton sportswear 100% organic, having a child care center on its premises, and reducing its energy use by 60%. In addition to being the founder of Patagonia, Yaman is a rock climber, surfer, and fly fishing enthusiast. Welcome.
Thank you.
I want to talk about falconry because that really is the germ or the origination for Patagonia, ultimately, indirectly. Where did your interest in falconry come from when you were in your teens?
Well, I think it was just early teens, in fact. I don't know. I read a National Geographic article from a 1920 Geographic by the Frank and John Craighead about hawks and falcons, and I just got interested in it. And I got in with some other young fellows, and we started kind of a little club of falconers and would go around and climbing to hawks' nests and taking birds and training them, and then but also banding birds for the U.S. government and stuff.
Now, this was in Southern California?
That was in, yeah.
Your family lived in Maine before moving to Southern California. Why did they move?
Yeah, well, we moved when I was about 7 years old because my father had asthma, and my mother thought the climate would be better for him in California.
And for the first 7 years of your life, you went to a French-speaking Catholic school.
And that's right.
You spoke only French at home, too?
Yeah, this was in Lisbon, Maine, and everybody spoke French in Lisbon, Maine. They were all French-Canadians who came down from Canada to work in the woolen mills.
And when you moved to California and you started speaking English, do you remember that transition for you?
Yeah, it was tough. You know, as soon as we got to California, I was put in public school, and everybody, of course, spoke English. And I remember a few days later, I just ran away from school. That kind of set me on a different path the rest of my life.
Do you remember where you ran to?
No, I can't even remember that far back.
What are some other examples of your difficulty in adjusting?
Well, you know, in high school was a horror for me. I mean, you know, I had pimples. I was the shortest guy in school. I certainly didn't go to the prom, that's for sure. I was probably down in the bottom of the LA River gigging frogs and catching crawdads. And I mean, I've had a life in nature all my life, really, and it's saved my life.
Do you have any friends from your high school years or from your childhood? Or were you?
No.
What did your parents do?
My father was a tradesman. He could build an entire house by himself. He was a plumber, electrician, carpenter, mason, could do everything. Mm. Now, even though he only went to school till third grade, and that was it.
And how about you? When did you stop going to school?
I actually went to 2 years of college, in a junior college in California. At the time, I was working part-time as a private detective. My brother owned a private detective agency, and 18 years old, 19 years old, I was working as a private detective and going to school. But one day, I just was standing in line waiting to get my books for the next semester, and I just walked away, and it's the best thing I've ever done. I think I knew what I wanted to do, which was at that time I was doing a lot of climbing, and I wanted to make climbing equipment.
I want to dig into this private investigation, private detective work. What are some cases that you looked at?
Well, I was mainly working for Howard Hughes. This is when he was hiding out in a Beverly Hills hotel, and they were trying to subpoena him. And he had a whole bunch of so-called starlets all around town. And my job was to tail these starlets, and it's just all hanky-panky stuff.
And for those who don't know who Howard Hughes is, who is Howard Hughes?
Well, he was a Hollywood mogul. He was a pilot. He was quite a character. But in his later years, he was pretty crazy, and he did a lot of crazy things, and which required a lot of private detectives.
But your calling was in the wilderness.
Yeah, that's right.
We talk about falconry being the genesis of all this. What does falconry have to do with rock climbing?
Well, I learned to climb by climbing to falcons' eyries.
Eyries are the homes of falcons?
Yeah, that's the nest up on cliffs and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And that's how I learned to climb, you know, using old manila ropes and not really knowing what we were doing, because there was no schools on climbing in those days. You had to learn the hard way, taking a lot of risk and barely coming out alive. Training falcons got me interested a lot in kind of Zen Buddhism philosophy. And my first lesson was basically trying to train a wild falcon. And you trap one and you put it on your fist and you put these jessies on his feet. And you try to stay up all night with him until he finally falls asleep. And that builds trust in the bird very quickly. But, you know, the Zen master's got to say, you know, who's getting trained here? You know, you got a 12-year-old kid having to stay up all night until this bird finally falls asleep.
So you developed this interest in rock climbing because you wanted to go to the nests of these falcons.
That's right.
At the time, this is in the late 40s, early 50s, there was no infrastructure for climbing. What equipment did you use?
Well, we used, I mean, in the beginning, we used, you know, Converse tennis shoes to climb in. There were no climbing shoes. Then we started getting some equipment from Europe, and specifically pitons, you know, the spikes that you drive into the rocks. And in those days, the pitons were made out of soft steel because the European attitude towards climbing was to conquer the mountains and make them easier for the next party. Hmm. You know, that's kind of the manifest destiny that created America, really. You know, tame the wilderness. But we were brought up with the philosophy of John Muir and Thoreau and Emerson and, you know, the American naturists who believe that you shouldn't alter nature and just you should go into nature and leave no trace of having been there. So I wanted to make some pitons out of hard steel and so that you could use them over and over. And they worked really, really well.
And this was when you were roughly 19, 20 years old.
That's right.
You became essentially a blacksmith.
I borrowed some money from my folks and went out and bought an anvil and a coal-fired forge and got some steel from the junkyard and pounded out my first pitons. And I used them for myself, and then friends wanted some, and then friends of friends. And then pretty soon we were on the cutting edge of rock climbing, these huge walls in Yosemite, you know, that take 10 days. And in fact, you had to have my equipment if you were going to do that climb. You know, I've been a craftsman all my life, kind of, and I love working with my hands. And I love looking at a product and saying, you know, I can make that better. I'm not an inventor, but I'm an innovator.
You mentioned Yosemite. You also would hide out in Yosemite when you you were overstaying your visit. What was that about?
Well, you're only allowed to, in those days, to spend 2 weeks in Yosemite. Well, you can't do much climbing in 2 weeks. Some of those climbs we were doing would be on the wall for 10 days. And so, you know, we'd spend months there. So we were outlaws. We were basically hiding, living in the boulder fields. And
eating what?
Well, I remember 1958, I guess, I took off for the summer and I stopped by this store in San Francisco that sold damaged cans, and I bought cases of damaged cat food and 10 cents a can. And, you know, I spent the summer eating porcupines and ground squirrels and whatever I could scavenge. Mm. I mean, that's what we did.
So here you are, you're pioneering all this equipment for the rock climbing industry out of necessity. Where did it go from there?
Well, it turned into a business. I mean, and it wasn't just rock climbing equipment. I mean, we kind of reinvented all the ice climbing gear. In fact, the stuff was so advanced, so ahead of its time that nobody even knew how to use it. So that was the first book I wrote. I had to write a book on how to ice climb, which kind of revolutionized ice climbing.
You were producing objects that literally supported your life, and that requires a good deal of confidence. I would never trust myself to build a device that really had my life in its hands. How did you feel about that?
Well, we were very careful, and at the time I had a partner, Tom Frost, and the two of us were designing and making this stuff. We were the only ones that did all the quality control and everything. I would take buckets of these pitons or carabiners or other tools at home and do all the inspection and quality control myself. And we had an attitude of making the absolute best climbing gear in the world. That was our philosophy. And
And the name of your company was Chouinard Equipment.
that's right.
You were pioneering this equipment, but at the same time, you were harming the rocks,
Well,
even though
that's,
you were reusing the pitons.
yeah. When I first started climbing, there was only maybe 250 serious climbers in America. But in the 70s, the sport kind of exploded, and more climbers doing the same routes over and over again. And they're putting in these hard steel pitons in the cracks and taking them out. And pretty soon we're realizing that it's leaving a big hole in the crack. So I felt that, okay, this is our fault. And so I felt, okay, since it's our fault, we need to be the ones to do something about it. And so we put at risk 80% of our sales in pitons and switched over almost overnight to a different method of protecting climbing by these little aluminum chocks that you put into the a constriction in the crack with your fingers, and you pull it out with your fingers, and it causes no harm whatsoever.
And when you're on these climbs, what part of your interest in climbing is the physical versus wanting some solitary moments?
Well, I don't think solitary has much to do with it, but I think the purpose of climbing is to affect some sort of spiritual or physical growth, and it has everything to do with how you get up there. Well, like if you climb in Yosemite, you get to the top of a 10-day climb, and there's nothing there. There's just the forest, and that kind of is the opposite of. Say some high-powered businessman paying $85,000 to be guided up Mount Everest. And what's important to him is to get to the top, not how you get to the top. And that's wrong. That's not what climbing is about.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Yvon Chouinard, founder of Patagonia. We'll hear more from Yvon coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Yvon Chouinard, founder of the outdoor apparel company Patagonia. In addition to being the founder of Patagonia, Yvon is a rock climber, surfer, and fly fishing enthusiast. What about the life of the mind? I mean, you were very active with your hands and climbing, yet you didn't enjoy school at all. What did you do to exercise your brain's development?
Well, I've been a book reader all my life, and so for a couple of years there, I was drafted into the army when I was 21, I think, and so I decided to read 100 books while I was in the army.
By the way, what did your mother do? You mentioned what your dad did.
My mother was a housewife, but my father was not an adventurer. My mother was the one that really wanted to travel and really wanted. She liked change. I'm much more like my mother than my father.
Except for the working with the hands
That's
component.
right.
So, what happened to Chouinard Equipment, this company?
Well, eventually, I sold it in the early 80s to the employees because I had started Patagonia, the clothing company, in 1973, and I was trying to run two companies. I couldn't do that. It was just too much. And now it's called Black Diamond. And they continue to make the best climbing gear in the world.
We mentioned before how Patagonia came from falconry. Falconry developed your interest in rock climbing. And then when you were rock climbing, you started wearing rugby shirts. And rugby shirt was really the germ of Patagonia. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I was on a climbing trip to Scotland in the winter, And I came back from the trip, and I had bought a rugby shirt because I thought, hey, this is a cool shirt. And it's got a collar, so it worked really good for climbing because it was really tough material. The collar was protecting the gear sling from your neck. And it came in, you know, some bright colors and stuff. And at that time, men's sportswear had no color to it at all. All it was gray sweatshirts and sweatpants. That was it. And here I'm wearing this bright blue rugby shirt with the yellow and red stripes on it. And people were saying, wow, where'd you get that? And so the lights came on. I started importing a few, and they sold like crazy. And it started a whole fashion. That's how I got into the clothing business.
And why did you name it Patagonia?
Well, in 1968, I took a trip with my friend Doug Tompkins and three other guys.
He's the founder of North Face and Esprit.
We drove from California to the tip of South America, and I fell in love with that part of the world called Patagonia, the southern part of Argentina and Chile. And I wanted to start making clothing, and I thought Patagonia would be a good name because that's the kind of conditions I wanted to make clothing for, you know, ferocious winds and storms and these icy peaks. And I thought that would be a good name for a company.
You started the company in 1973. You were in your early 30s at the time. What was going on with your personal life?
When I was 32, I guess, I married my wife, Melinda, and she got involved in the business. And, you know, a few years later, we started having kids, and the company grew. And she is much more of a people person than I am, and she's been very good at HR problems. And she was responsible for starting a childcare center, which when we did that, you know, before we did that, we had employees coming to work with their kids in a cardboard box on their desk.
trying to hide the child.
Yeah, I mean, we've always operated like a different style business, like a family. So we wanted our family close to us. We didn't want to just leave home and leave the kids at home and drag ourselves back to work. And it turned out we had some screaming babies that were affecting everybody's work. So she thought, hey, it's a good idea to put in an on-site childcare center. And at that time, there was only 50 in the whole United States.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Yvon Chouinard, founder of the clothing company Patagonia. So we're talking about the early days. How did you finance the company initially?
Well, it was all we were self-financed, which works up to a point. The problem is we came out with a product that we call Cinchilla, which was a fleece. We were the first ones to come out with this. And when we did, it took off. And our growth, I mean, we were growing 50% a year. So we were growing 50% a year for several years, and you can't do that on retained earnings. You're gonna end up in financial problems. So we got in a really big financial trouble, and at the same time, there was a recession. And we had planned to do 50% that year. We bought the inventory, we hired the people, and we only grew 30%. We couldn't borrow any more from the bank. In fact, our bank was in financial trouble. My accountant introduced me to some mafia guys who wanted to lend me some money at 28% interest, which ironically is what people pay with their credit cards now. So anyway, I had to do a lot of soul searching. So I took about 10 of our top people down to Patagonia. We walked around for about 10 days and would walk for a while and then sit down and say, okay, what are we doing anyway? Why are we in business? None of us had a degree in business, not one person. We all had degrees in biology and English and sociology and anthropology. And you know, I had a degree from John Burroughs High School in auto mechanics.
Was that, by the way, on purpose, that none of your employees had any background in business?
Yeah, we didn't want to hire any greaseballs.
And so here you are financially strapped in a recession, and you say, how are we going to rectify the situation? Let's go to Patagonia.
Well, it's the best thing we ever did. Because, you know, we were able to write down why we were in business. The farmer has the responsibility to leave the farm in better shape than he received it. The forester has the responsibility to leave the forest, take a few trees out of the forest and not clear cut it. and leave it in good shape. But somehow business is exempt from having any responsibility to do that. So we decided to put our business on a 100-year track, which means we had to control our growth to, you know, 5% or certainly less than 10% a year. So we don't artificially create a demand. We don't put ads on inner city buses to try to get the gang kids to wear our black down jackets rather than North Face. We keep trying to sell to people who need the product rather than want the product. And that got us out of this crazy growth that caused all our problems.
So you didn't have to raise any capital?
No, we didn't have to raise. Well, you know, I had to borrow money from friends and things like that. But I did have to lay off a bunch of employees that we had hired, which was something that I swore I would never do again.
How much capital did you put into the business initially?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. It's year to year. I don't really know.
So are we talking like $300,000, $30,000, $3 million? You don't recall at all?
No, I really don't.
Even which decimal place were
you? No.
We talked about the recession, but what else was challenging for you?
Well, I still don't like the business part of it. The hardest part is finding the right people to work for you. If I'm interviewing somebody across the desk from me, I'm horrible at it because I believe everything they say. And so now when I interview somebody, I bring in a bunch of women who see right through everybody. They're much better at it than I am.
For sure.
I've made a lot of mistakes in hiring the wrong people.
You mentioned earlier when we were talking about falconry, you alluded to Zen Buddhism.
Uh-huh.
What influence does that have on your outlook?
I mean, some people approach Zen Buddhism by meditating. I kind of approach it through action. And I've applied it in all my sports and applied it in business. Like, for instance, if you ask me what our profits were last year, I completely forgot. I have no idea what they were. I have no idea what they're going to be this year. I couldn't care less. I'm focused on the process. And if you're focused on the process of business, the profits come.
Now, for those who don't know about Zen Buddhism, what is like the central tenet of Zen Buddhism?
Well, I don't really know, actually. I wouldn't be able to answer that. And probably the Zen master would probably say the same thing. Well, you know, I mean, people say, okay, you've been a risk taker all your life. I don't take any risk at all. I do my homework. And if you do your homework, you don't take any risk. And like, for instance, I've been a whitewater kayaker and doing dangerous rivers, first descents of rivers and things like that. But the day I really learned how to kayak is I did a river next to my house in Wyoming. That is a difficult river, and it falls, you know, more than 100 feet a mile. And I did it one day without a paddle. If you don't have a paddle, you have to think way ahead. You have to be seated correctly in the seat. And you basically have to go down a river like a fish. And I did that, and I had a perfect run. And so people say, wow, that was a crazy thing to do. That was really risky. You know what? It wasn't risky. The worst that could have happened is I would have lost my boat and picked it up a few miles down and I would have swam out. But by taking small risk, it gave me the confidence and the technique to not be so dependent on my paddle. And so then I went on and did lots of first descents of very dangerous rivers because of taking a small risk in the beginning. And so in business, that's how I operate my business. We take lots of small little so-called risks so that we don't take the big ones.
You do not use email, and you constantly lose your cell phone. I think you dropped it in the toilet or the river recently.
I actually hate all electronics. I don't even know how to turn on my television. And I think it goes back to when my father was an electrician. When I was a little kid, he'd say, hey, come on over here. And he'd stick his hand in an electrical outlet and then grab my hand and give me a shock, and he'd laugh. Ever since then, I've hated electronics. But yeah, I don't have a computer. I try to live a simple life. So I'm slowly getting rid of a lot of stuff.
A friend of yours said, behind every Luddite is a woman with a computer.
My wife is the most wired woman in America.
So what does cause you the most angst if you're striving to get rid of so-called stuff? What provides you with the most anxiety?
Certainly, I feel guilty about flying all over the world and doing these sports. I mean, I'm certainly going to be in that seventh level of hell that's fueled with jet fuel. But I try, you know, not to fly first class or fly in private airplanes or any of that stuff, which is even worse.
So that's the stuff that burdens you.
Yeah.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Yvonne Chouinard, founder of the outdoor apparel company Patagonia. You made a switch to all organic cotton in the 1980s. And for thousands of years, farmers have been producing cotton organically. Why did farmers start using pesticides to grow cotton?
Well, it's not just cotton. Pesticides all started from World War II, pretty much. From a lot of the toxic things that they use in war. Yeah, before World War II, everything was pretty much organic. I mean, the lights came on for me one day when we put a store in Boston. We outfitted an old building and we redid it, and it was springtime. We brought in all our sportswear.
On Newberry Street?
Yeah, on Newberry Street. And within a few days, our employees were complaining of getting headaches. So I brought in an environmental engineer, and he checked things out. He said, your ventilation system is recycling the same air, and you're poisoning your employees. I said, well, what are they getting poisoned with? Well, formaldehyde, he says. He says, it's all on that sportswear that you have out there, all that cotton clothing. I said, what? Then I find out that a label that says 100% pure cotton is, on the average, 73% cotton. The rest are chemicals put on the cotton afterwards to control shrinkage and pilling and wrinkling, stuff like that. The most common chemical is formaldehyde. You know, in biology class, you got a lizard in a jar, and that jar is filled with formaldehyde. It's really toxic, and we're all wearing it. Well, I said, I don't want to be in business if I have to use formaldehyde, which led us to realize that we didn't know what we were doing. We were just buying cloth and, you know, already dyed and just making clothing. So that's when we decided to work on an environmental philosophy. And I gave the company 18 months to get out of that game, even though it was, you know, 25% of our business. Well, that got everybody's attention. And I've never seen the business operate better. So, I mean, we had to go in partnership with some farmers and lend them money so that they could buy their seed, because the bank wouldn't lend them anything because the banks are in collusion with the chemical companies. And I mean, it was, and then, you know, the spinner wouldn't spin our cloth because the cotton came in with seeds and stems and sticks, and it was sticky because of aphids, you know, those little white bugs that you get on your garden, and it makes it real sticky. So the stuff was sticky, wouldn't go through the machines, and finally we found, you know, one spinner in Thailand who developed a process of freezing the cotton before he put it in. And I mean, it was very, very difficult to pull it off, but we have not used 1 ounce of non-organic cotton since 1986.
What are some of the current initiatives going on in the industry?
We've been involved with a bunch of very large apparel companies and retail companies in creating a sustainability index for clothing. We have probably 60% of the apparel market in the world represented in this group of companies, and we're leading it. Our little company, Patagonia, is leading this, and what we're doing is going to end up where somebody can walk into a department store and there'll be 5 pairs of jeans, and they'll be able to zap their iPhone or whatever electronic thing they have onto the barcode, and it'll give a grade, and it'll tell you the whole history of that product. And you'll be able to make a decision as to which one of those 5 brands of jeans you want to buy, according to how responsibly they were made. That's a huge revolution.
Although, you know, the word organic is so hackneyed these days, you don't really know what organic means anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why we want to do this ourselves. We don't want the government to do it. It's just like, you know, I didn't wait for the Rangers in Yosemite to tell me to stop making hard steel pitons. We decided to do it ourselves. We think that we'll have much more stringent and more truthful index if we do it without the government.
You have a program called 1% for the Planet where you donate 1% of your sales or 10% of your profits, whichever mm-hmm. is greater. Can you describe that a little more?
Yeah, it usually ends up 1% of sales. We look at it as being a cost of doing business because we're polluters. There's no way you can make a product that's sustainable. There's no such thing as sustainability. We feel guilty about what we're doing, using up non-renewable resources and making, you know, a lot of sportswear and things like that. So we take that 1% and we give it to about 450 different environmental organizations.
And so what are sales roughly?
We're 350 million.
Okay, so that's about $3.5 million a year.
Yeah, we've given away about $40 million over the years.
Incidentally, can I see your hands for a second? They're well worn.
Oh, they're worn, all right. My whole body's well worn. There's a lot of internal damage.
What occupies your time these days? You're not doing blacksmithing anymore. You're not as
I still do it, but I do it as that's my sandbox.
So what do you make in your sandbox?
Oh, I make like the other day I made some crampons that you put on your feet for wading real slimy, rocky rivers. So it's a fishing product. And I made it in my blacksmith shop, and I was just in British Columbia testing it. And then I make, you know, I make hinges for houses. I make fireplace sets. I make all kinds of different things. But I have to work with my hands every day. And like I cook at home. If I've been pushing papers around all day, I have to go cut vegetables or do something. I have to do something on a daily basis.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
My guest has been Yvonne Chouinard, founder of Patagonia.
Coming up, we'll meet Stephen McDonald, founder of Applegate Farms. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Stephen McDonald, the founder of Applegate Farms. Applegate is a natural organic meat company that has been part of the natural meat movement since the early 1980s. The company's meat is sold in delis and natural food stores like Whole Foods and Trader Joe's across the United States. Stephen started Applegate when he was 32, and he used to be a vegetarian until he sold a healthy meat that even he would eat. Applegate supports over 200 family farms who are dedicated to the humane treatment of animals. Welcome. Stephen, before we go into the history of Applegate Farms, I'd like to know exactly what Applegate Farms is.
Applegate Farms is a natural foods meat company that provides about 130 different products, meat products, all cooked or processed, as we call it, bacons, hot dogs, deli meats, chicken pot pies, nuggets, items like that.
I want to understand what led you to this point, and I'm wondering what you were doing before you founded Applegate, which you founded when you were 32 years old.
Right before getting into Applegate, I was working for my brother-in-law, who is an Irish glassblower named Simon Pierce, who's got a small glassblowing business in Vermont. And I had been a management consultant in Boston, getting bored with all the kind of theoretical, wonderful ideas, but couldn't get my hands into anything. And this was 1986, at the point that his business was taking off and needed some support. So I went to work for him and just fell in love with the small business environment. At that point, I knew that I needed to do something on that level, which ultimately led me to Applegate.
You were working for Simon for how long?
I worked for him for about 2 years.
How come you didn't continue working with him?
Well, I left that because when I got in there, we started to turn things around, and I looked at this business, and I said, Simon, you're my brother-in-law. He's married to my oldest sister, Pia. And I said, Simon, you've got to cut me in on this. I'm your brother-in-law. And he thought about it, and the day I asked him, he was lying flat on his back with his back going out. And, of course, I chose that perfect moment to walk into his office. He's lying horizontal on the floor to propose this idea that he cut me in on his business, which he had started in the early 1970s. So he, in his very typical, charming Irish way, said, let me think about it, and came back a couple of weeks later and said, no, I don't think that's a good idea for you or for me. Of course, I was completely stunned that he wouldn't want me there. in retrospect, that's the best thing that ever happened to me because it forced me out to just go get on, you know, find something on my own.
Right. And so did you say, okay, fine, if you're not going to make me part of the management, I'm leaving. Was it that sort of vitriolic?
Oh, yeah, no. And it was obvious to him when he said it that we could no longer continue because I really crossed the equity line. And when you cross the equity line, you're in with both feet or out with both feet.
What did you do from there? You're like, okay, I'm no longer working for Simon Pierce and I am now just going to go start a meat company? Or
no,
how did that happen?
You know, as I said, before Simon, I'd done the management consulting. At that point, I was so frightened. I knew that I wanted to be an entrepreneur, and everything that I had done had led me to that point, but it's still obviously a very scary step. So I immediately tried to retreat back into management consulting and had these interviews with these management consulting firms who in the first 5 minutes said, Steve, you do not want to go back into consulting. You need to go out and do something on your own. So I just started looking for a business and ran into a friend at a New Year's Eve party who told me about a business that he was looking at and said, well, we can do it together. So I went and looked at this company called Jugtown Mountain Smokehouse, which was the original name. And it was a small, you know, 5,000 square foot smoked meat facility. And I said, Chris, you know, this thing is too small. Either you do it or I'll do it. So he called back a couple of weeks later and said, I'm not going to do it if you're not going to do it. And so I kind of jumped in.
You mentioned that you were entrepreneurial, like you just felt that you had it in your blood. How did you know?
Well, having struggled through school and been in a lot of academic environments where I wasn't motivated or excited, I always knew. I was the kid that, you know, in high school they said, well, you just got to wait till the guy gets to college before he does something. And then I go to college and they said, well, you're just going to have to wait till after college. So it was in the small business environment that I felt like my brain woke up. What I say to people is my IQ goes up and down in direct proportion to how close my butt is next to a fire. So if I'm at high risk, I get very smart. As soon as I start working for somebody else and it's not mine, I just don't have the same mental acumen or focus or interest to solve problems, to try things, and my creativity just kind of goes down if it's not mine.
Did you have any influence from your mother or father in the business world at all? What did they do?
My mother was taking care of 9 kids, and my father was an investment banker, you know, in New York. Neither of them had direct entrepreneurial experience. I think my father taught me how to reach out and connect with people, networking. My mother was more of the one who taught me that I could do it. And she, if she was, you know, 30 years old now moving into a career, there isn't a company in America that she couldn't run well. And even though she wasn't in the business environment, she taught all those principles of focus and will and desire about, you know, getting whatever it is you want to do.
So moving from your family life to this natural meat company, how did it then go from Jugtown to Applegate Farms?
Well, we were doing nitrate-free product and product that was not using phosphates or, you know, adding water to the product. So we were in a very high-quality product, but we hadn't migrated yet to antibiotic-free or organic meat. So the business started to grow, and we had these old gravity pit smokehouses, which are just the old-style smokehouses, which had been there for years. And we got those smokehouses going so fast and running so often that we basically lit 2,000 pounds of bacon on fire one night when it was smoking overnight, and the whole back end of the business burnt down. So those are one of those seminal moments when you think the world's coming to an end after you've worked so hard. In 3 weeks, we had that back up and running, and this is with USDA inspections and controls. But in the interim, we had to tell our customers to go to our competitors to get product. And we had to go to our competitors to have the stuff we needed made in the interim. So all of a sudden, we started getting these shipments in from our competitors or different people. And we were like, well, this stuff's better than what we do. And at that moment, I kind of realized there was tons of production facilities doing smoked meats and other type of meat. What there really wasn't was a brand out there that was dedicated to focusing on producing healthy organic or natural meat that was focused on the consumer.
So it was all by accident, in a way, that you discovered that you wanted to be in the natural organic meat business as a result of your smokehouse burning down and getting the meats from your competitors?
Everything we've done, we've learned by mistake or as an accident. The percentage that we knew what we were going to do when we grew up and actually executed to that level, the day-to-day is all 90% stumbling.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Stephen McDonnell, the founder of Applegate Farms, a natural organic meat company that sells products to Whole Foods and other natural food stores around the United States. Walk me through the life of a cow in your company. Let's say you're a cow in Uruguay. How does it end up on my dinner plate in New York?
When you say no antibiotics, you're basically saying they'll never be sick, which means you have to completely change the way that you treat them. The difference between organic meat and antibiotic meat is they're raised exactly the same way. One is fed organic grain, certified organic grain, and the other one is not. But in all cases, you never use antibiotics, and you're never using animal byproducts. So the analogy I use is if you've got children, if your kids are going to go to a daycare center, and you are going to say you will never give those kids any antibiotics if they get sick, there are a couple of things you're going to do differently. You're going to make sure you feed the kid very well because you don't have the backup of giving an antibiotic. So nutritionally, you're going to focus. And in this case, it means not using animal byproducts, which are cheap meats, but very good grains. You're also going to house them differently. So you want them to have access to fresh air. You want them to have sunlight. You want them to exercise. They need room to exercise. And so the physical environment is much more attuned to supporting the immune system and building the immune system of each of the animals. And then the third piece of it is sanitation and control. So what needs to happen, these barns need to rest. So every once in a while, you have no birds or animals if they're in houses and let the natural process of germs disinfect itself and then restore it. If you try to cram the animals up too tightly and accelerate their growth with hormones or steroids, feed them lousy feed, you're going to get systemic diseases. On the humane issue, what we feel is that these animals ultimately are dedicating themselves to becoming food for humans. And our responsibility is to honor that process, respect those animals, and give them disease-free environments that are healthy and ones in which their immune systems can support their growth.
So they go from this life of luxury to the slaughterhouse in, let's say, Uruguay. And then, right. Then what happens?
Then what happens is we will take whatever we're making, if we're making roast beef or we're making beef hot dogs or whatever, we'll send the appropriate meat to the different processors who then receive our raw material, and then they have strict quality control standards. They can only run this product first because you can't be running commercial product and then our stuff without doing a whole sanitation process in the interim. So we're usually brought in, and we can take the date code of a product that you buy in the store, and we can trace it back to the lot that it was made at the processor. We can also trace it back to the lot when that animal was slaughtered, and we can also trace it back then to the farms. So traceability is a very important issue for our consumers and for us to know what we're actually receiving at the end of the day.
So take me back to the very beginning. Before your smokehouse burnt down, how did you fund it initially? Did you have outside capital or was it all your own?
I closed in July of 1987, which was right before the October crash, mm-hmm. stock market crash. I went to a bank who ended up loaning me 120% of the purchase price. So I had $35,000 left over in my bank account, which I was able to use to start buying inventory and paying payroll. And so as it turned out, I never put a dollar of my own or anybody else's into the business.
And why were they willing to lend you money?
I had a local banker, this old street guy named Bill Purcell, who basically loaned money to gas stations and small grocery stores. I went back to him and, several years later, I go, why did you do that? Because, of course, after the 90s and the whole, banking issues, everything now is loaned on ratios and a banker has no leeway to kind of, give the money that they want just because they like you. He turned to me and he said, I know you're going to be successful. And he went out on a flyer and that's what got me started. And when I go meet now these big bankers who want to help me grow my business, I always try to remind him of that guy who, never made it into the big banking world, but was, for an entrepreneur, exactly what you need to get started.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Stephen McDonald, the founder of Applegate Farms, a natural organic meat company that sells products to Whole Foods and other natural food stores around the United States. We've been talking about the early days of the business, and I'd like to know how you went about selling the product to customers initially.
The story that I remember most in the early days was my uncle, who was an investment banker in New York, had sold A&P to a German company. And so I was like, great. Well, you know, I called him up and said, can you get me a meeting with this, you know, with A&P? They're a huge chain, you know, here in the East. And he said, sure. So he called up the president, who then got me a meeting with the meat buyer. So I go traipsing into the meat buyer and sit down and say, hi, I'm Steve McDonald, you know, my uncle, blah, blah, blah. And I, like an idiot, told him, you know, where, how I had gotten to him. And he turned to me before the meeting had started and he stopped me and he goes, listen, son, if you think that I am ever, or this chain will ever buy a single pound of your product because you came from the president of the company, you are sorely mistaken. Now, I have one piece of advice for you. Pick up your stuff and get out and don't ever come back. And it's true now as it was then. In the meat business, you work yourself up the ladder. You go in the ground floor and you earn your stripes. And that was a great lesson, although it was kind of shocking at the time.
You've been humbled by this A&P experience. So do you now just call the founder of Whole Foods, or do you get in through the butcher, through the meat department?
We were just starting out. They were just starting out. We were kind of like minds and just became kind of friends. And they started requesting meat that was raised without any antibiotics at all. So then we started to go out and find farmers and set up growing systems that raise those animals without antibiotics.
I want to turn to your initial partner, Chris Ely, whose father had owned the smokehouse that you acquired. And I was wondering if there are any partner issues between you and Chris.
The reason this company happened in large part was because of how easy that relationship has been. He allowed me from day one to be in control and totally saw that I was a vehicle for him because he didn't have the background I had to help this company realize its dream. So doesn't mean we don't go at it on several occasions. There was never a point where we came to, had discussions saying we're not going to work together. It's just been a wonderful, easy relationship, and I know how rare that is to find.
And it's partly easier because he relinquished control to you and he didn't have an ego about that, because you do like to be in control.
No, that's true. And he saw that and very wisely stayed away from it. He, like me, is married to a very strong woman, so both of us, you know our boundaries in certain areas, and we figured that out pretty early
on. So you're
on.
Humbled at home, but at the workplace, you like to stretch your arms a little more.
I'm way humbled at home, and I'm often humbled in the workplace, but I can kind of push back a little bit more in the workplace.
And so your wife, what's her name?
Jill Carney.
She was there throughout the growing years of the business.
She was there and never was her gift to me. Her father's a sculptor. So what she brought to me was an understanding of small business and a love of small business. And she was in the movie business, so she was in a very stylish, fancy business with lots of attention and distractions. And here she was living in Los Angeles at the time. She would fly back east to hook up with this guy who had this small smoked meat company in New Jersey. And none of her friends in Los Angeles could understand what that was about. What that was about for her was getting back to her father being a sculptor and being working with his hands and working in a real environment. So that support, knowing that I was okay, because when I bought the business, I was so nervous about doing it and so unsure about what I was doing. I didn't tell any of my friends. I just did it. And that validation was very important. She now is getting much more involved in the company and helps out on the text on the back of the boxes are all her words. And she is a writer, and she has a way of writing our message that I think keys into our consumers far better than anybody else I've seen.
We're getting to the current stage of the company, and I want to ask you how your role has changed from the very, very early days of getting this off the ground to now a manager of how many people?
We've got about 65.
So how are you as a manager in addition to being an entrepreneur?
Well, I'm great, but you'd have to ask the employees to get the honest opinion.
Well, what would they say?
I've had a lot of employees work for me for a long period of time, and I've only lost one employee, someone who was in customer service, who I didn't really want to lose. I feel that ultimately I need to hire a number two. So
and right, you're not threatened by that at all?
I'm totally threatened by that. I think I have way too much of my identity wrapped up in this company, which is what I've been doing nonstop. I think as the company gets bigger, to have the owner and founder that wrapped up in the business is not healthy.
And do you have advisors telling you that, or are you internally recognizing that yourself?
I don't have a board of directors, and everybody's telling me I need to, and I will eventually do that. You know, this is more from an internal reflection than it is other people. The business is going very quickly through its teenage phase. And so if you have been a entrepreneur for 18 years like I have, it's like raising your children up into the teenage years and realizing that you can't be a shrink to your own teenage child, that at some point somebody else needs to step in and do that. And there's a function there. Doesn't mean you're going to stop being the parent. You're always going to be the parent. But the child needs more than just the mom or the dad around. And so it's kind of coming into that realization.
Well, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Stephen McDonnell, the founder of Applegate Farms. To learn more about the show, visit our website at fromscratchradio.org, where you can download a podcast on iTunes, follow us on Twitter, or join us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.